From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Bill Moyers on politics, religion, and television. Also today, shooting the president, with a camera, that is. Photographer George Thames tells us about his 40 years as White House photographer for the New York Times. Rock historian Ed Ward sets down his headphones and picks up some books about rock and roll. And a cult classic is now out on home video. Owen Gleiberman reviews the Rocky Horror Picture Show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet television has reported that 176 people were killed today when an airliner crashed near the Siberian city of Yakutsk. The report said that the Aeroflot plane lost its wings as it was making an approach to land. The story conflicts with an earlier report from the independent news agency Interfax. That report said everyone aboard the plane escaped and that only one person was taken to the hospital. French President François Mitterrand said today that he was prepared to support a possible United Nations resolution authorizing the use of force in the Gulf. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
President François Mitterrand said a UN resolution authorizing the use of force might be necessary to liberate Kuwait, and he said he was willing to sit down and discuss the wording. France is one of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council. It's also the only member that's managed to free all of its hostages. Until now, France has been hesitant to support the U.S. proposal for such a resolution, but Mitterrand now seems to think it's necessary to step up military pressure on Iraq. He called again for the release of all foreign hostages held in Iraq and Kuwait. He said their lives were not negotiable, and he said Baghdad's freeing of batches of hostages at a time was unacceptable. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher has repeated her declaration that she'll continue to stand for the leadership of the Conservative Party, despite having failed to secure enough support in the first round of voting to defeat her challenger, Michael Heseltine. From London, Michael Goldfarb reports.
The Prime Minister made her statement before leaving Downing Street for Parliament. She had spent the morning meeting with senior Conservatives amid rumors her support from the first ballot was crumbling and that she was being pressured to step down. The Prime Minister reported to the House of Commons on the summit meeting in Paris, then took questions from members of Parliament. She was in fighting form. When the Social and Liberal Democrat leader Patty Ashdown referred to her as being in the twilight of her premiership, she replied that it might be twilight, but there are 24 hours in the day. The Prime Minister's political troubles are far from over. Tomorrow, she returns to the House of Commons to face a vote of no confidence in her government. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Goldfarb in London.
Former Wall Street insider Michael Milken was sentenced to 10 years in prison today for violations of federal securities and tax laws. And the 44-year-old financier pleaded guilty to six felonies in April and agreed to pay $600 million in compensation. Milken could have faced as many as 28 years in prison. The former executive at Drexel Burnham Lambert is credited with pioneering the use of high-risk junk bonds to finance massive corporate takeovers. Stock prices came to a mixed close on Wall Street today after drifting in pre-holiday trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 9 points to close at 2,539.36. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bill Moyers has developed a devoted television audience by doing the type of programs that the experts say there's no audience for. His documentaries, specials, and reflective interviews have won just about every award in the books. Perhaps his most popular series was Joseph Campbell, The Power of Myth. The Power of the Past is the subject of a new program that will debut on public TV Wednesday, November 28th. For this program, Moyers traveled to Florence, Italy, to examine the Renaissance and its influence on the present. Writer Umberto Eco and director Franco Zeffirelli are among the people Moyers speaks with on this program. From 1963 to 67, Moyers was a special assistant to President Johnson. Moyers has spent 19 years in broadcasting, alternating between CBS and PBS. Interviews on TV are often disparagingly referred to as talking heads. I asked Moyers if he was surprised that his had caught on.
I really wasn't that surprised because I never lost faith in the production value of the human eyes and the human voice and the human face, even though we were moving so deeply into a visual age. Also because growing up in the South, where conversation was a part of the hearth, and looking other people in the eye was a part of protocol, and where I knew people liked to listen to stories, I just simply had, it's built into me that democracy is a conversation and that people really do love to listen to other people and learn the oral tradition. As you know, in Fresh Air is such a part of our culture that if you find a way to keep it alive and keep it interesting, bring on people who have something to say, you'll find an audience.
You were ordained as a Baptist minister. How long did you actually preach?
Well, I didn't really preach. I studied to be a teacher. I laugh because you said to preach. I thought of the time I took my clergy mentor, Dr. Carlisle Marney, to the White House at a reception, and I kept introducing him as Dr. Marney. This is Dr. Marney. People thought he was a physician. Some lady said to him, "Oh, Dr. Marney, what do you practice?" And he drew himself up full 6 feet, 2 inches, and said, "Madam, I don't practice, I preach." I did more practicing than I did preaching. I wanted to be a teacher, and I thought in a religious institution. I did some student preaching on Sundays thanks to the tolerance of those congregations in the rural towns around the seminary and around the university. I remember once preaching a sermon on sin, and a farmer came up to me after it was over. All these were rural folks. These were small churches out in the country. He said, "Brother Moyers, you haven't sinned. You're not old enough to have sinned enough to preach about it." And you know, I really thought that's probably right. I'd better go out and sin a little.
So did you?
I did.
You want to tell us what you did when you made that decision?
I went into journalism. Isn't that
sin enough? Right. So you never really had a pulpit?
As a student. Okay. I would go out, and we would call student pastors. They'd give us on-the-job training, so to speak. And I had never more than 30, 35, 40 people in the congregation at a time. Good folk, farm folk, folk no longer there. I go back to visit some of the churches now. They're gone. I mean, the buildings are there, but the people are not there.
When you left the ministry, did you also leave the faith at all, or was your conviction as strong when you left?
Well, conviction is perhaps the wrong word for it. A commitment to grow was certainly there. I still consider myself a man of faith, although I think Joseph Campbell put it into perspective for me when I said to him one day in the interviews I did with him 2 or 3 years ago, "Well, you're a man of faith." He said, "No, no." He said, "It's not faith that does it for me. It's experience, being in the world, and then taking from those experiences your insights into God and into yourself and into that intersection where life and faith mix and meet and mingle and send you on your way to the next destination." Some of the simple premises of my childhood faith I have put behind me. As Paul says, "When I was a child, I spake as a child." But I'm not a child anymore. So I still consider myself a pilgrim, decidedly so. I would not want to be in this world without some sense of providence.
Bill Moyers is my guest. I'm sure you recognize his voice. And I should tell you that he has a new program that will premiere November 28th on public television. It's called The Power of the Past, Florence. I think you were in your 20s when you went to work for Lyndon Johnson and you became his special assistant. Was it like a father-son relationship that you had with him?
Not at first, and certainly I wouldn't want to characterize it as that because I wouldn't know what it was in his mind. I mean, we admired each other. I loved him. I think he came to have a kind of filial love toward me. But like all fathers and sons, if that is an apt analogy, we quarreled. We had our disagreements. We misunderstood each other. But I felt very close to him and miss him even to this day.
LBJ was an expert at power politics. Was that something you wanted to learn from him?
No, I grew up thinking of power as something that deeply involved the exercise of public service, that it was something that you did not for its own sake alone, but for the sake of what you could accomplish with it. I was a New Deal Democrat without knowing that's what I was. My father never talked about anybody but Franklin Roosevelt, never voted for anyone in his middle years except Franklin Roosevelt. I saw what the New Deal had done in East Texas to people in desperate plights, and so I was that kind of native Democrat. I never thought of politics as the exercise of power for the sake of power until I got to Washington.
There's certainly a lot of power politics that goes on behind the scenes in broadcasting. Do you feel that what you learned from Johnson in observing his use of power has been helpful for you in your career?
Probably much of what I've learned in my life has been by osmosis and not by by explicit application of lessons drawn. And I suppose I picked up a great deal about how to get other people to accomplish my purpose with me, how to trade here and there in order to get what one wanted, but also to know that once you play the game for the sake of the game, you're finished as far as any fruitful purpose is concerned. And so I've never wanted to simply be at a network or be in the industry to simply be there. It's what I wanted to accomplish with it that I think being in Washington helped me to see and to do.
You were Johnson's press secretary.
And my credibility was so bad we couldn't believe our own leaks.
You couldn't what?
Believe our own leaks.
Well, you were the press secretary during part of the anti-war movement. Were your sympathies divided then?
Well, the first 2 years in the White House, I was Lyndon Johnson's political and legislative assistant, and I was responsible for helping to draw up all of those social programs that we put into effect, some with positive results and some with negative results. But that was my great interest. I paid no attention, wasn't asked by the president to pay any attention to Vietnam until it really had become much more than a cloud on the horizon. It had become a thunderstorm above us and around us. And as I became I became press secretary by default and by his insistence, even though I had told him at the time I really didn't want to do it. And I found myself not being a spokesman for the things that I really knew about and cared about, but ultimately becoming more and more an explainer of a war I did not myself understand, and a war which, while I supported, I wish I could go back and say I was a moral prophet and stood early against the war and said, this is outrageous and wrong. But I wasn't. I went along. The president believed that what he was doing was necessary. The people he listened to, McGeorge Bundy and Bob McNamara and Dean Rusk, felt the same way, too. Who was I, a 30-year-old, in the White House to really challenge those experts? My doubts begin to grow privately. I begin to be troubled, even though I could understand what the rationales were for the policies. I begin to wonder if the rationales were really true. And in time, I came to be unable to speak for the war as I had been. And ultimately, not for that reason only. I left 2 years before Johnson left Washington.
Were there things that you found hard to defend the president for?
Oh, sure. The president was given to outlandish exaggeration at times, like on a flight of imagination and rhetoric while he was in Vietnam on a visit. He talked about how his grandfather, or great-grandfather, I think it was, had died at the Alamo. Well, I knew that. I never heard that story before, and when I researched it, I found that it didn't. He died in a hotel with an unnamed lady, maybe to cross the street from the Alamo. I don't know. But it was that sort of exaggeration, that sort of innate duplicity that became hard to rationalize and to explain. He was just a secretive man in that sense, part by his own upbringing and part by his experience in the Senate. I found that hard to rationalize.
I have to ask you something about what Morley Safer said about you in his recent book Flashbacks, which is a memoir about reporting in Vietnam. And he said that, in 1965 he did a report on how U.S. Marines torched the village of Cam Ne because it was believed that there were Viet Cong there. And he says, after the report, President Johnson called Frank Stanton, who was then the head of CBS, to criticize him for running the piece. And then in a meeting between Stanton, Johnson, and you, Johnson threatened that unless CBS fired Morley Safer, the White House would go public with information about Safer's communist ties. And Johnson said that you and he had the goods on Safer. And then Safer wrote that Johnson said that you and he had the goods as a result of an investigation launched by the FBI, the CIA, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and that later you had met with a CBS News correspondent who tried to smooth over the relationship between CBS News and the White House, and you snapped at him. His name was Murray Fromson, and said, "Why do you have to use a foreigner to cover the war?" Meaning that Safer was Canadian and not American. Safer says he found it hard to reconcile these actions with your role as public defender of the First Amendment and the rights of minorities. What's your reaction to his criticisms?
Well, first of all, Morley got it wrong. Morley was in Vietnam at the time, and anything he knew about that had to come secondhand. He was not in Washington. He was in Vietnam. Second, he's just flat wrong when he says that Lyndon Johnson called Frank Stanton down, and in a meeting with Stanton and me, that Johnson dressed him down and said all these things. I have a letter from Frank Stanton denying that. He has no recollection of that, and I can assure you he would have remembered that. He says it isn't true. I say it isn't true. There's no question but that Lyndon Johnson railed and ranted against correspondents with whom he disagreed. There were two in particular that he found reasons to harass rhetorically, verbally. I never saw him do anything to try to discredit a correspondent, with malice, that sort of thing. He just lost his temper at them, and Morley was one of them for that report. I happened to have thought at the time that the report was a very good report. I saw it. I was sitting in the White House when I saw it, and it was one of those occasions when I realized that the war out there was different from how it was being presented in the official view of things. And Johnson would take on in a generic way any correspondent that he found telling a story at odds with the official view of reality. He railed about Morley Safer. He railed about Peter Arnett. He railed about Douglas Kiker of the Herald Tribune. He railed about Walter Lippmann and all of this. But did he call in Frank Stanton and dress him down? No, Morley has it wrong. And I wrote Morley to that effect. I told him that. I had the Frank Stanton wrote me. Morley had a chance to correct that in his book, and he didn't. Now, I don't know why he didn't. You have to ask him that. But he's got many of his facts wrong in there.
Bill Moyers is my guest, and his many public television series include Joseph Campbell on the Power of Myth, The Public Mind, and A World of Ideas. He has a new program called The Power of the Past, Florence, about the heritage of the Renaissance, and that premieres on public television Wednesday, November 28th. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Bill Moyers is my guest. You started in television when you were 37 years old, after having worked as special assistant to Johnson and then after having served as publisher of Newsday. Since you started at the age of 37 and you hadn't come up through the ranks of television, did you feel like you'd have to make your mark in a way different from other reporters who came up through the ranks of TV?
No, I really wasn't conscious of that because, rightly or wrongly, the experience I had as a young man, as a teenager in high school and working full-time on the local newspaper, my work as assistant news editor of radio station KTBC in Austin when I was at the University of Texas, I certainly hadn't been in the big time, but I had been a very good reporter, had a lot of experience. I remember once when I was 17, the chairman of the school board called the publisher of the newspaper and said, "What in the world are you doing sending a student up here to cover the school board? He can't do that." And Mr. Cope, who was the publisher of the paper, said, "Give him a chance." And the next day, the long story about the school board meeting was as straightforward and as accurate and as complete as anyone would have expected from someone twice my age. So I was a good reporter and continued to think I would be a good reporter when I was in Washington. And coming back to journalism was, in fact, coming home.
You were really one of the few correspondents, I think, who I can think of from national TV, network TV, who've made their reputation doing interviews, among other things, but not combative interviews,
Well, I'm not a very combative person. I'm more interested in you than I am in me. I'd rather be talking to you, drawing you out, finding out what it is you think, than I am in offering what I think. I mean, I do essays, I do documentaries. That you mentioned the special next on the 28th on Florence. The night before, there's a 90-minute special on Frontline that I have done called High Crimes and Misdemeanors, in which I take on, which I look at the role of Ronald Reagan and George Bush in the Iran-Contra scandal. I do have things to say, and I say them from time to time, but mostly I'm deeply curious about other people and other people's ideas. I was a good student in high school and college. I learned from wonderful teachers, and ever since then I've thought everyone is a teacher. You know, we journalists are generalists who are licensed to explain things we don't understand. And if we're going to explain them, we have to talk to people who know them, who can articulate them, who are passionate about ideas. And I just am turned on, so to speak, by people who love the language and can articulate their thoughts in ways that are compelling and which from which I learn and benefit and grow.
Perhaps your most popular series to date has been your public television series, The Power of Myth. It was a series of interviews with Joseph Campbell about myth, ritual, religion, art, psychology. After the success of the series, and the series was broadcast after Campbell's death, after the success of the series, Campbell posthumously became the subject of controversy for reportedly making anti-Semitic remarks and for taking certain anti-Semitic actions. Did you see evidence of that, and do you believe those charges?
I never saw evidence of it. I knew Joseph Campbell, knew him well for 11 years. I did 7 hours of television, 8 hours of television with him altogether. I have read every word he ever wrote. You will not find in any of his great works, Hero of a Thousand Faces, Masks of God, the anthology of mythology, you will find nothing that would reflect anyway the bigotry and anti-Semitism attributed to him by Brendan Gill. In the times that I knew him, the times that I was with him, in the times that my executive producer Joan Connor and others were with him, he never once reflected that. I was surprised when Brendan Gill wrote the piece. He gave only anecdotal evidence. He talked mainly about his conversations with Joseph Campbell at the Century Club. He offered nothing but his own personal recollections and a couple of other people he had talked to. And I cannot tell you that Joseph Campbell, when I didn't know him or when he was with Brendan Gill, didn't make remarks that he might well have been ashamed of. But I never heard him make them. There's nothing like that in his works. And he exhibited to me nothing that would justify that charge against him. And since Brendan Gill got wrong, the one thing I do know about Joseph Campbell, I happen to think he probably got that wrong too. For example, in the second half of that article you were talking about, he says that Campbell's idea of following your own bliss was responsible for the yuppiedom and Reaganism philosophy of the 80s of get it while you can and put yourself first and aggrandize your own interest. That is not what Joseph Campbell meant by follow your bliss. And Brendan Gill had read the book, read Joseph Campbell's books, and listened to the television series, he would have known that what he said about his philosophy was at odds with what he really believed. And if he got that wrong, he could have gotten the other charge wrong, too.
I always find that I'm shocked by everything I don't know about somebody, even people who I think I know very well, and I'm sure you found that to be the same too. I'm wondering if indeed there was evidence that in parts of his life he evidenced some anti-Semitic actions or beliefs. How would you reconcile that with his other beliefs? Do you think that would negate his celebration of the complexity of the human spirit, or would it just be testimony to his own complexity and to the unpredictability of people?
Well, we're all out of a culture from which we're constantly trying to escape, and Joseph Campbell came out of a deeply Irish a culture with a sometimes justifiable hostility toward, biased against the British. He was a man of strong opinions. I wouldn't be surprised to learn that he might have uttered in moments, private moments, remarks that we wouldn't like. But he was not a person who did that publicly, or we would have known about it. And it tells me that, in the same sense that all the recent charges about Martin Luther King's plagiarism, well, it says to me that he wasn't an original scholar, but at the moment when the time came for him to be used by Providence for a great purpose, he was there and he rose to the challenge. Now, I think the same thing is true of a Joseph Campbell. If he felt bigotry in his bones, if he felt prejudice toward anyone, he wrestled sufficiently to overcome those so that they were not reflected in his books. That, to me, is a testimony to a man's or woman's ability to deal inside with his own nature, his own intuitions, his own flaws and weaknesses.
So you'd forgive him for a certain degree of anti-Semitism?
I would forgive him for being a flawed human being, yes. As, you know, if he had been a flagrant anti-Semite who had used his scholarship and his public opportunities to express absolutely.
What if he used it to keep people out of, say, a dining club?
I would deplore that, but we'd have to then deplore most of the people we know above 60 years old in our society today, in the country, in the place where I grew up. Some of the, I do not understand the complexity of the human soul. Some of the best people I know, with a quote around best, belonged to segregated country clubs in the South where I grew up, still do today in many places, and yet they're deeply generous and thoughtful people. It takes a long time and a deep struggle to overcome your culture when your culture is confining and isolated and sometimes malicious. But I certainly wouldn't say, well, that changes his ability to compare religions in the world, or that undermines his scholarship, or that undermines his writing. It's only when you look at the writing, assess it, analyze it, apply it to your own life, that you have to ask, well, was he reflecting the kind of bigotry or the kind of prejudice that was alleged about him? And he wasn't. The same is true of other people I know.
Bill Moyers, your programs on television explore human complexity, and they take time to reflect on issues. They're more slowly paced, more contemplative than, you know, nearly anything else on television. But it seems to me that there's probably a paradox in your life that I think is probably a fairly common paradox for someone who would be in your position of doing reflective shows but in a high-pressure business, and that is that in your own life, you probably don't have time to be that reflective or to take time. You probably have to be very fast, be very compulsive, and be very aggressive and assertive in order to get your programs on the air, not just in public television, but when you were at CBS.
Yeah, I sometimes have a reputation for being hard to work with because in this business you have to fight constantly against a lot of inertia in order to accomplish what you want to do. Look, when you have an idea for a television show, it doesn't exist except in your mind. And there are so many forces you have to then organize in front of you to accomplish that idea, to take that idea out of your imagination and make it happen on the screen 3, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 months later, that you really do have to be purposeful, resourceful, stubborn, persistent, skillful, political, but always in the end determined not to compromise the idea that woke you up in the middle of the night and said, hey, I'm good, make me happen.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. I really regret we're out of time.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for doing it. My guest has been Bill Moyers, and his new program on public television is called The Power of the Past, Florence, and it premieres on Wednesday, November 28th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The last 10 presidents, from Franklin Delano Roosevelt to George Bush, have been photographed by George Thames. Coming up, Thames tells us about his four decades as White House photographer for the New York Times. Also, rock historian Ed Ward tells us what rock books he's been reading lately. And if you've wanted to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show, but never had the energy to make a midnight show or the stamina to watch it in the company of its cult following, now you can watch it on home video. Owen Gleiberman has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Egyptian President Mubarak says that time is not on Iraq's side and that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein miscalculated badly when he planned his invasion of Kuwait. Larry James reports from Cairo.
Mubarak was quoted in a newspaper interview today as saying the Iraqi leader thought his actions in Kuwait would draw only verbal protests. He said Saddam mistakenly thought his actions would go unnoticed in the shadow of other international events, that time would be on his side, and that he could keep Kuwait forever. The Egyptian leader said Saddam miscalculated badly, and that the international alliance against Iraq will remain firm in its insistence that the occupation of Kuwait must end. Mubarak also said he is amazed at Saddam's inability to comprehend the level of international condemnation of his actions. He said no effort has been spared in trying to avoid a destructive war and said he hoped those in Baghdad will wake up to save the world from such a crisis. For National Public Radio, I'm Larry James in Cairo.
President Bush is now in Saudi Arabia, where he said today that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein sees a strong coalition armed force against Iraq's occupation of Kuwait. The president said the pressure is increasing on the Iraqi leader, and if he doesn't understand it now, he will soon. At the close of the Paris summit today, Soviet leader Gorbachev was a speaker, and he said that he remained supportive of U.S. efforts in the Persian Gulf. Kevin Connolly of the BBC reports, though, that important differences remain between the two countries.
The CSC summit has, to a large extent, been dominated by a round of intensive diplomatic activity involving the leading non-Arab countries in the alliance against Iraq. There have been persistent reports that the American delegation was finding it difficult to persuade the Soviet side to commit itself to a timetable for possible military action against Saddam Hussein. But President Bush, speaking before he left Paris for Saudi Arabia, said any differences between the two sides were extraordinarily minor, and he gave a broad hint that action might be taken at the UN before the end of this month. But President Gorbachev was also careful not to disclose the possible contents of any proposed UN Security Council resolution, and he stressed the continuing need for unity. It's clear that there have been differences, at least of emphasis, between Washington and Moscow over how to proceed against Iraq, and more importantly, perhaps, when.
Kevin Connolly, the BBC. More than 1,000 anti-government demonstrators marched in central Bucharest today, shouting down with communism. The march was held in memory of those killed during the 1989 revolution, when, according to official government figures, over 1,000 people died. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 9 points to close at 2,539.36 on volume of some 141 million shares. Declining issues led advances by only a slight margin. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Some of you who listen to our rock and roll historian Ed Ward each week probably figure he just knows all this stuff about rock, chart positions, birth dates, and tragic personality flaws. But Ed says he couldn't write his pieces for us without a bunch of other people's research he reads in liner notes and books. He has a review of some of the latest rock and roll books.
1990's been a good year for rock books. I've got 15 of them sitting here, including two novels. The novels, Laurie Colwyn's Goodbye Without Leaving and Mark Childress's stupefyingly boring retelling of Elvis's early career, Tender, aren't really worth bothering with. So we turn to the world of fact. The 50s didn't get much play this year. But Thunder's Mouth Press did reprint James Brown's autobiography, which was ignored when it was first published a few years ago. It's an amazing collection of James's one-of-a-kind opinions and self-myth-making, with some facts mixed in.
Watch me! Watch me! I got it! Watch me! I got it! Hey! that makes me want to shout. I got something that tells me what it's all about. I got soul and I'm super bad. I got soul and I'm super bad.
The only other notable book from this period is Joel Selvin's rather worshipful biography of Ricky Nelson, Idol for a Generation. Its main problem is evident right there in its title. Nelson was, of course, no such thing, but reading about his long decline is fascinating. As for revelations, Selvin proves that drugs were not involved in the plane crash that claimed Nelson on New Year's Eve 1985. There's also some hot innuendo about his two sons, who are now the light metal group Nelson. Phil Spector was a child of the 50s who helped invent the 60s. Few people were in a better position to observe him than his ex-wife, Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes. She's now written her autobiography, Be My Baby, with Vince Waldron. Ronnie peers seductively off the dust jacket, so this looks like a heaping helping of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But if that's what you're looking for, you're going to be disappointed. The sex happens off the page, except for several steamy sessions with John Lennon, which end with Ronnie telling him no. The drugs are the alcohol she consumed, mostly alone in Spector's mansion, to block herself off from the fact that she was imprisoned there. And the rock and roll pretty much ends with her marriage to the overprotective, paranoid Spector. There's the usual AA stuff and happy second marriage, but not much insight into Ronnie or her life and times. It could be, of course, that rock musicians are just thick. Certainly that's the impression I walked away with from reading Rolling Stone bassist Bill Wyman's autobiography, Stone Alone, which he wrote with Ray Coleman. Close to 600 pages long, it ends at the Hyde Park concert following Brian Jones' death in 1969 and features appendices with Rolling Stone's legal papers and every gig, broadcast, and record the Stones did in those years. The text also tells you Wyman's bank balance every couple of weeks and details of all the girls he slept with, lusted after, or fondled from the time he was 8 years old. I literally fell asleep twice trying to read Stone Alone, but the book does pick up as Wyman details Brian Jones's slow decline into death. And no, I haven't read A.E. Hotchner's book, Blown Away, which purports to reveal that Brian Jones was murdered and who did it. But Wyman convinces me that Brian did it to himself. There are a bunch of Jimi Hendrix books out for the 25th anniversary of his death, but I only read two of them. Inside the Experience is drummer Mitch Mitchell's account of his years with Hendrix, and as such, it's fairly interesting, but co-author John Platt has padded Mitchell's words with dull connective material, and all the color photos, uncredited, bloat this into a $27.50 monster that's not worth the money. On the other hand, Charles Shar Murray, one of Britain's best rock writers, has produced a masterpiece in Crosstown Traffic, a book on Hendrix that examines his relationship to blues, black pop music, rock and roll, jazz, and American society in general. Murray has a knack for making connections and producing a masterful analysis of a lot more than just Jimi Hendrix. This was also the year when some serious attention was paid to the business of music. Frederick Dannen wrote Hitmen, a horrifying expose of independent promotion men. Dorothy Wade and Justine Picardy did a good biography of Atlantic Records founder Ahmet Erdogan, Music Man. Between them, these books paint an all too realistic picture of the way things really work in the biz, and I can't recommend them enough. And of course, there's my friend Robert Draper's account of Rolling Stone, The Uncensored History, which modesty forbids my praising. I should also add that Grill Marcus, another friend, has a new edition of his famous book of essays, Mystery Train. and Robert Christgau, the self-styled Dean of American Rock Critics, has come forth with Christgau's record guide, The 80s, which reviews and grades 3,000 records and, I think, also shows a critic losing enthusiasm and perspective for his work. So there I was, figuring I had the year's rock books wrapped up when in came Timothy White's Rock Lives, 700 pages of profiles and interviews. Sorry, Tim, I know you're good, but after Tender and Stone Alone and all the rest, I just can't do it. It's time to read something without a beat.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Honey, bleed,
this is Fresh Air. George Thames has photographed every American president from Franklin Delano Roosevelt to George Bush during his long career as White House photographer for the New York Times. He was named Photographer of the Year three times by the White House News Photographers. Thames grew up in Washington, never living more than 10 blocks from the Capitol. He's retired now, but he's collected his best presidential photos in his new book, Eye on Washington. When he took his first presidential photos, he learned there was an unwritten set of rules White House photographers were expected to follow when taking pictures of FDR.
No pictures of the president being carried, no pictures of the president being pushed in his wheelchair. Of course, when I arrived, these rules were already in place, and I arrived on the scene in 1939. And so in further inquiry, I found out that apparently when the President Roosevelt came into the White House for the first time in 33, that Steve Early, his press secretary, had a meeting with the White House photographers who covered for the various wire services and the theater newsreels. And at that time, there were so few of them, you could fit everybody into one room. And he told them that everybody knew the president was crippled, that he had had polio, but that the president had a request to make of his friends, the photographers. And that is, if they would refrain from having him photographed while he was being carried, that he in turn would make himself available more to them than any other president in the past. The photographers kept their part of the deal. The president never kept his part.
Never kept his part?
Nope. Everything was contrived. Situations were few and far between. And we never got any pictures of the president that he didn't want.
Can you give us an example of a photo opportunity that seemed very contrived to you, but because of circumstances, you had to take the picture?
Well, there were so many of them. We just had the annual turkey shoot, which we refer to the annual turkey shoot just last week, where the president receives the Thanksgiving Day turkey. That used to be quite a picture for us. We would always count on a lively turkey, and we would make gobbling sounds or do something to make the turkey jump, and the president would really react to something like that. If you saw the pictures that were made this last turkey shoot, they were just like a walk in the woods. I mean, it was a very, very sedate type of picture. The turkey was so big and so sedated that he couldn't move, and the president and we used to stand back there, and I'd make sounds like a and the turkey would look around, and then one time with President Reagan, I asked the president, the turkey wasn't moving and things looked pretty dull, I yelled at him. I said, "Mr. President, what are you going to do with that turkey?" He says, "I'm going to eat him." I said, "Well, why don't you go and pet him and sort of show you don't mean it personal?" And so he went over and touched the turkey, and the turkey went straight up in the air. And we got one hell of a funny picture out of that. But we never got another one, because he was very much aware of that the next time, and so was the White House staff.
So that it won anything might be at all embarrassing or unusual to show up.
That's correct, unless they particularly want it themselves. I mean, the president going swimming or wearing casual clothes or what have you. Everything that's photographed today of the president, by and large, is set up. Every once in a while, he'll surprise the photographers and surprise President Bush particularly, by, say, diving into a pool or diving into the ocean when it's cold, and everyone is caught by surprise. When you go back and photograph him pitching horseshoes or anything like that, it's all set up. We're all invited, and we stay within a certain area, and we photograph what we can. That's why we try to shoot sidebars. We look around and see who else is of the staff that's there that might be making news, Sununu or some of the others, and you just concentrate on them for a bit to try to get something a little different.
What are the kinds of circumstances where you feel that you're being more than the president's publicist when you're taking photographs?
Well, I think the only times that would happen is occasions when I was given free rein, say with Johnson and with Kennedy and with Ford, where I spent hours with him, and I just observed him from a vantage point, say a door, where I would put a chair just outside of his door, and every once in a while I'd look in and see what he was doing, and then I'd slip in and very quietly make a few exposures and then get back out again. I think that was a situation where we weren't controlled and we weren't told what to do, but I had a perfect, I knew what I was doing, and I was trying to show what the presidency is like, what the affair. That's how I got that picture of Kennedy on the cover of the book. I mean, it was a candid shot. I saw it. I went in. I stood by his rocking chair, made two exposures, and then walked out of the room again.
Why don't we describe the photograph? It's Kennedy with his back turned to the camera. Why don't you describe it?
Well, you say it's. I titled it "The Loneliest Job in the World,"
mm-hmm.
And he's at his desk, but he has gotten up and is working by using that little table that was directly in back of his chair, but you could just see the weight. It looks like the weight of the whole world is on his back, and it was taken during the time of the Cuban crisis. So it's a shot that'll live forever. Because it really shows what the office really means, and what effect it has, and what pressures there are.
Now, Reagan is certainly considered one of the most photogenic presidents, and one of the presidents who knew the most about how to use the media, particularly because of his background in film and television. But you say he was very uncomfortable with still photographs.
Yes, he was, and I couldn't understand it until I put the question to him. One time, deliberately, I said, Mr. President, why is it that you stiffen up every time the still cameras come around? And he says, I can't recover from a still. And I looked at him kind of puzzled, and he says, yes. He says, if I'm on television or doing something involving film, movie film, he said, if I flub, I can cover it with a joke or with a gesture. He said, I can't do it with a still. So I got to thinking, and that's right. If he puts his finger up his nose, and when we get it, he's going to look stupid, no matter how he tries to recover. But on film, he could follow it with a joke or a gesture and get away with it.
You took the photograph of Eisenhower that was used on the Eisenhower stamp.
That's correct.
Would you describe the shot and tell us how you got it?
Well, one of the things that all good photographers do, and that is we watch people. And after you've watched them a while, you know their mannerisms or you observe their mannerisms and you try to recreate those. It's particularly when they're very, very revealing, I would say. One of Eisenhower's mannerisms, when he was wearing his glasses, these half glasses, and he would read and then he would whip them off and hold them dangling in his hand, and then look off in the distance while he's thinking. Well, this made a very nice photograph, and when I watched him doing it just before he went on air for a broadcast involving the war in Korea. And I sort of kept my back to him, and then I was about 4 feet away, and I was watching him, and all of a sudden he made that same little gesture. So I turn around, and holding a flashlight high, and my flash high, and the camera low, waist level, the Rolleiflex, I fired one shot, ba-boom, and hit him that way. And he had sent the word out that he was looking for an official portrait of himself, and he didn't want one made by a studio, one of those formal types. And I asked the photographers to submit some of the pictures they were making of him. And I submitted mine, and he wrote on it, okay.
You photographed all the presidents since FDR.
That's correct.
What is it that makes a president most interesting for you to photograph? Is it the facial structure? Is it, you know, the way their face is shaped? Or is it something about the character underneath that that's revealed in the body and in the face?
I think it's the character underneath. And I think that, and also how basically the human we all are, with all our failings and so forth, that they are in occupying the most powerful position the world has ever seen, the President of the United States. And yet, they're all human beings with all the problems that we have, and that if you can show this, in spite of the position that they hold, I think you're doing justice not only to them but to the world. I looked at the faces and body language, anything that would bring out what I consider the true character of the individuals, whether they're president or a man down the street digging a ditch.
George Timms, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
And George Timms' new book is called Eye on Washington, The Presidents Who've Known Me. It's a collection of his photographs and his accompanying text. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. The Soviet Union appears to be moving closer to going along with the United Nations resolution authorizing the eventual use of force in the Persian Gulf. Some consternation in Europe about the fact that President Bush seemed to pay more attention to the crisis in the Gulf this week than to the important political developments as 34 world leaders assembled there in Paris for a three-day meeting. Linda Wertheimer reports on the children of Killeen, Texas. Lots of parents there are now off serving in the Persian Gulf. And we will have a remembrance of a country doctor and his wife and their time together in Rappahannock County, Virginia.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. After nearly 15 years of playing midnight shows, the Rocky Horror Picture Show has finally come out on video. Critic Owen Gleiberman sizes up the new incarnation of the cultiest cult film.
In the 70s, cult movies came in two flavors. Some, like Pink Flamingos and A Clockwork Orange, were nihilistic and disturbing, sort of like the punk rock movement they helped inspire. Then there were movies like Harold and Maude and Outrageous, which were sweet, even sentimental at the core. But then there was the cult film that stood alone, the low-budget drag queen horror comedy that ended up becoming a kind of weekly Halloween party for the midnight movie set. What was it about the Rocky Horror Picture Show that inspired such passionate devotion? The movie's plot is pure silliness about a pair of dorky all-American kids, played by Susan Sarandon and Barry Bostwick, who end up stranded at the castle of the divinely decadent Dr. Frankenfurter, played by Tim Curry. The Rocky Horror cult started out as a gay phenomenon. For a lot of people, going to midnight shows in Frankenfurter drag was a soothing, even stylish way of coming out of the closet. But the film was soon embraced by a larger audience. And that's because it was the one midnight movie that was both subversive and sentimental, outrageous yet safe. On the one hand, Rocky Horror celebrates giving in to your kinkiest fantasies. The film's high point is undoubtedly Tim Curry's lip-smacking rendition of Sweet Transvestite.
Don't get strung out by the way I look. Don't judge a book by its cover. I'm not much of a man by the light of day, but by night I'm one hell of a lover. I'm just a sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania.
Parading around in his corset and fishnet stockings, Curry is triumphantly lewd, a cross between Tom Jones and Jane Russell. Still, his terrific performance is the only truly scandalous thing in the movie. Even as Rocky Horror urges you to throw off those middle-class chains and give yourself over to absolute pleasure, the film says that when you do, everything will be sweetness and light.
Don't dream it. Be here. Don't dream it.
In its second half, Rocky Horror devolves into a meandering and, to my mind, rather tedious series of set pieces. Yet I'm not sure it would have become the phenomenon it did had it been a better movie. In essence, the folks who came back week after week to engage in a call and response with the film's grade Z dialogue had found a way to merge with what was happening on screen. And that depended on the movie itself being pretty lightweight stuff. Rocky Horror was certainly ahead of its time. It anticipated the Fredericks of Transylvania fashion trends that would dominate the late 70s punk scene. If only the movie had had a punk soundtrack to match its attitude. Richard O'Brien's tunefully schlocky songs are too close to Broadway for comfort. When it was announced that Rocky Horror would be released on video, some greeted this as a stake through the heart of the movie's midnight cult. But frankly, I can't think of a better place to watch the Rocky Horror Picture Show than your own living room. The truth is that the film's high-camp naughtiness was domesticated long ago.
Owen Gleiberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross. Have a good Thanksgiving.
Why don't you stay for the night?
Night.
Or maybe a bite.
Bite.
I could show you my favorite obsession. I've been making a man with blonde hair and a tan, and he's good for relieving my tension. I'm just a sweet transvestite from transsexual.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember the life and music of Irving Berlin with Berlin's biographer, Lawrence Burgreen. Also, we talk with the latest member of the Carter family to make it in country music, singer Carlene Carter. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.